Our company specializes in low-cost SR22 auto insurance. We know that mistakes happen and offer free quotes for very affordable auto insurance meant specifically for you, the overpaying high-risk driver. The quote is free and we'll handle the filing so you could start saving money. Call 800-758-0725. 800-758-0725. 800-758-0725.
Saturday is World AIDS Day. December 1st has been set aside as a day to raise awareness about HIV and AIDS. U2 frontman Bono, in an interview with Jenna Bush Hagar from NBC's Today Show, talks about his role as a consultant to former President George Bush on HIV and AIDS.
PEMFAR is the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, and your old man has led the world on, I think it's the single greatest health intervention in the world, in the history of medicine, you know, fighting a single disease.
The SEC championship game between Georgia and Alabama is being held this Saturday in Atlanta. USA Radio Network's Robin Walensky reports.
Ahead of the big SEC game Saturday in Atlanta, fans of both teams making predictions at Hester's Restaurant and Grocery in Fayetteville, Georgia, mostly Dogs fans and a lone Alabama fan.
So who are you rooting for in the game?
The Dogs.
Here at Hester's Restaurant and Grocery, diehard Dogs fans gearing up for the big game, making predictions over breakfast with a lone Alabama fan.
This call from Peachtree City. Roll Tide, roll, baby. Bama's going to win.
But don't tell that to Phil from Fayetteville.
I've been living here for about 50-something years. The Dogs, naturally, Kirby Smart, yeah, he's going to do good.
Malcolm saying,
"This is going to be a knockdown dragout, and whoever's the best to win."
Kickoff in Atlanta is set for 4 o'clock Eastern time on Saturday. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com. And I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Good afternoon. Sorry, we're starting late today. Traffic was more than a little bit of a problem. So I am apologizing. I hope there was, I think there was some dead air. My name's Pat Smits, and the program It's the Law. We have some cases to talk about today, some other things that are happening in legal news. But first of all, let me just tell you, on this last day of November, hard to believe, but that's the case. Luckily, we're not in the northern plains, because we would be getting severe storms, and we're not getting great weather, but at least it's not as bad as we could have been expecting if we were out in the Midwest. And of course, now that the fires are finally out in California, they're getting all of the severe rain. And if you've ever seen a mudslide, you'd understand how this is, good news of fires are out, but not good news, because now all the mudslides and roads and homes. Mud can be just as, a little different than fire. That takes everything away, but the mud can do the same thing. So in any event, what are we looking for? Well, if you haven't been out, we had what they said is a slight chance of showers this afternoon. I think most of the area is getting rain or off and on rain. Tonight there'll be some decreasing clouds. Tomorrow looks like it's the best day of the weekend. It's mostly sunny. Then there is a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. By tomorrow night, we can expect 100% chance of rain. And into Sunday, initially about a 90% chance, and then showers, about a 60% chance of showers later in the day. Again, Sunday night doesn't look good because we are, again, more rain. By Monday, it should be partly sunny. So get out tomorrow and try to do the shopping in the afternoon, I guess, is the answer there. So what else is happening in the in the legal news? There are the capital legislation, follow what's going on with respect at cannabis legislation. There is a pending bill that allows an increase, also an increased use of ignition interlock devices in DUI sentencing, and the ongoing, of course, debates over the marijuana legislation. But the if you've ever been aware of how the interlock devices work, they really are a great, I'm totally in belief. I've seen how they work out in California. There was a recognition out in California that people need to drive. They need to drive to go to work. These ignition devices really, really do work. And the person, they're installed in the car. The person who has to use it has to breathe into it, and it can be done just randomly, and they have to do it within just a couple seconds. And they check them. The person who has to install them pays for it. I've been a believer in this for many years and don't know why it isn't used more often in New Jersey. Looks like this may be something that is going to be happening. So the New Jersey Supreme Court is set to hear whether the family of a teacher and his 5-year-old daughter who were killed in a car accident may sue the New Jersey Turnpike Authority, even though the claim was filed with the wrong state agency. So whether or not that will bar the people from filing is going to be argued soon, and it'll be obviously of great concern to at least this family, and probably a wake-up call to lawyers that they have to be extremely careful when they're filing these types of claims, that, in fact, the right agency is served. Now we have over 18,000 attorneys in New Jersey. That, I think, is about three times the number that were practicing when I first started practicing 40 years ago. There's certainly, a lot of questions, and the Bar Association is trying to gather information to help members who are meeting their obligation to do pro bono work. And that means that we all have to do some pro bono work, and it certainly must be extremely difficult to get a case when it's in an area of law that the attorney knows nothing about. I think that's an ongoing situation. So what's happening in some of the cases this week? Publication, of course, means that the case is precedent unless it's just a trial court. There is a plaintiff in the case Tully versus Mertz. This was an appellate division decision, and a plaintiff appealed from the dismissal of his complaint against the defendant following a one-day bench trial. A bench trial means that the judge is hearing the trial without a jury. So in this case, the parties were the sole shareholders of a closely held corporation that they jointly founded. Now, the parties failed to have a written agreement outlining how profits and losses would be split. Really bad idea. I mean, anyone who's in what they loosely call a partnership or an LLC or any type of business with another person or persons, they really must have a written agreement, because otherwise it just leads to, you know, all kinds of problems. Even if the two people get along famously, you know, what happens if one of them dies? So in any event, in the first 5 years, the parties in this case took equal salaries. However, the company subsequently experienced financial difficulties, and the plaintiff contributed significant funds to pay the company's expenses. Now, ultimately, the company defaulted on a loan, and a judgment was entered against it. Now, the plaintiff sued to recover 50% of the claim was substantial contributions he made to the party's company. The trial court dismissed the action after the one-day bench trial, and the judge concluded the plaintiff lacked standing because the action was required to be brought as a derivative claim on behalf of the company. So now on appeal, the appellate division affirmed in part and reversed in part and remanded in part, kind of the worst scenario. You lose some, you affirm, you win some, but then you have to go back for some other issues. So the appellate division ruled that some of plaintiff's claims were clearly direct in nature, including defendant's alleged breach of an agreement between the parties to contribute to the company's liabilities and his alleged breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. However, the appellate court found that other claims were derivative claims in nature, including the plaintiff's claim of mismanagement and conversion. So the appellate division acknowledged that because the parties were the sole shareholders of the company, plaintiff could proceed directly on those claims unless the company's creditors would be materially prejudiced if plaintiff pursued derivative claims as a direct action. So now the court had to determine whether the creditors would be hurt by this. Now, however, the appellate court concluded that it could not determine on the record if permitting the plaintiff to proceed directly would prejudice the company's creditors. So accordingly, they affirmed the trial court's decision to preclude plaintiff from proceeding directly on the derivative claims. So that was, you know, but the moral of that is that it is extremely foolhardy not to have a written agreement. And in fact, if one partner is contributing additional money, paying claims, etc., that should also be in writing before it's done in order to protect that party who is actually putting the money in. And it protects both parties because it's clear then if one party is putting money in, how are they going to be repaid? How is this whole thing going to be handled, etc.? So there is two Iranian men have been charged with operating a long-running international hacking and extortion scheme in which they targeted public institutions, including the city of Newark. And this was with ransomware causing $30 million in losses. So this was announced by the Justice Department. One of the other things, and I want to bring this to people's attention, because I almost was the victim of a scam. So be very careful. Tell your neighbors. Obviously, tell anybody who's older that this is coming, or they claim it's coming from JCPNL. I had a message actually, because I use my office phone for many things, including bills, the message came in that I had not paid my electric, and the electric was going to be shut off within 1 hour. Now, my secretary, who pays things for me and is always good about it, was not in the office. This happened yesterday, was not in the office, and I couldn't reach her because she was at a funeral. Now, it was odd to me. However, I called back, and the phone was answered. JCPNL person I talked to said that I owed $1,258 on my electric bill, which seems strange. But in any event, what he said I had to do was bring cash to an office in Trenton. Now, obviously, from where my office is, there was no way I could get to Trenton within an hour. So he gave me some alternatives. One was to go to one of the pharmacies in the area, and apparently you can buy a card that's considered a cash app and pay the pharmacy cash, and then they will send this on to the what he said was JCPNL. Well, I actually was concerned about doing that, and it turned out that I wasn't able. Well, so the other thing after he sent me to his quote-unquote supervisor was that I could do this if I downloaded an app on my smartphone. Well, guess I'm not too smart because I couldn't figure out how to download it. And, of course, being knowing that the smartest person that I would know who could do that was my grandson, and I called my grandson. Now, again, I was still skeptical about owing this amount of money, but, you know, figured, well, let me, you know, I didn't want the electric to be turned off in my office. Anyway, he was skeptical. So then what I did is I called the regular JCPNL number because I was told I could not pay this over the phone. The only way to do it was to, as I said, bring cash. So I called the regular JCPNL number and, you know, never get a person, but get this whole thing. And I actually paid the amount that they said I owed. But I knew I was paying it to JCPNL. It was being paid on my account number with JCPNL. And then the last thing that I was told is they had just received my payment. So obviously I was current. Well, I decided to call this person back. And again, phone was answered, JCP&L. I had a direct line into the so-called supervisor, and I told him that I had been able to pay it over the phone. I had a confirmation number. He said, "Oh no, no, that won't go through in time. You're going to still be your electric is still going to be turned off." Well, obviously, by this time, I was skeptical, and I thought that this probably was some kind of a scam. And when I asked him a few more questions, I said, "Well, I could give you my confirmation number, but I'm not going to pay anymore because I had confirmation that it was paid and they would be giving me credit as of today." Well, then guess what? The phone just went dead. But I have to tell you, I almost, and if it had been easier to do what he directed me to do, I may well have made a payment of $1,200, which, of course, was not going to JCP&L. Now, I did call JCP&L back and tried to, get the fraud department, and I won't even go into the problems that caused. But please make sure out there that when these scams, and as I said, I really didn't know whether or not my electric had been paid. I thought it had. But I didn't want to risk getting the electricity turned off. And I'm sure that they're apparently very, very successful, but they have this set up in such a way that they encourage you to call back, knowing that whoever answers will be answering JCP&L. And I'm sure they use this with other businesses, not just JCP&L. But I can see where easily one spouse would get that message and just think the other spouse had not paid the bill and go ahead and do it. So, in fact, if anyone gets scammed like that, I think they do need to report it to the prosecutor's office. I don't know where this is coming from. I wish now I had received and asked them for the actual address in Trenton, because obviously this was not a JCP&L address. And for most of us, we know that the electric service in that part of the state is from PSE&G. So in any event, a little bit of an aside, but watch out for scammers, especially this time of year. We all know that grandparents get called and say that usually a grandson, was arrested and needs bail money, and he's afraid to call his parents. That's another one that's really prevalent. So, what else is happening in approved for publication this week? The couple of criminal law cases, one in evidence, and this was State versus Green, and it's a Supreme Court case, and the state appealed from a denial of its motion to introduce defendants' two prior DUI convictions. What happened is the defendant struck and killed a victim lying in the road. Defendant's blood alcohol was determined to be 0.21% at the time of the accident, and defendant had two prior DUI convictions from 1998 and 2009, both of which required completion of courses at the Intoxicated Driving Resource Center. So defendant in this case was charged with vehicular homicide and DUI within 1,000 feet of a school. That's another issue, but in any event, the state moved to introduce defendant's prior DUI convictions, arguing they were relevant to the issue of recklessness because they proved defendant, quote, had knowledge of the substantial and unjustifiable risks, end quote, of a DUI of driving under the influence. The trial court denied the state's motion, ruling that the defendant's prior DUI conviction could be unduly prejudicial, as a jury could use them to conclude that defendant acted in conformity with his prior behavior in the incident. meaning he was on trial for vehicular homicide. The trial judge was afraid that a jury would conclude and find against the defendant based on the fact that he had prior convictions. So that was the reason for the denial. And I think that that unduly prejudice would be something that most trial judges, of course, would be very concerned about. And so in any event, the jury, the trial judge felt that the jury could use the prior convictions to conclude defendant acted in conformity with his prior behavior. And so the appellate division affirmed the trial court, noting that driving while intoxicated could alone, just by itself, satisfy the recklessness requirement of the vehicular homicide statute. And so the appellate division didn't think that they needed the prior 2 DUIs, because the one where he killed someone was sufficient. So now there was, now on appeal, the Supreme Court affirmed, ruling that the trial court did not abuse its discretion to exclude defendant's prior DUI convictions. Although the court acknowledged that the convictions were relevant to prove the defendant knew of and consciously disregarded the risks of driving while intoxicated, the Supreme Court agreed that the trial court and agreed with the trial court that the probative value of the evidence was outweighed by the prejudicial effect. And that's really what trial judges have to determine. And the Supreme Court also agreed with the appellate division that the state had far more probative and less prejudicial evidence of the defendant's recklessness in the form of his excessive blood alcohol reading at the time of the accident. So the two prior DUIs were not excluded. And this case, as I said, went up to the New Jersey Supreme Court. And it is important because the trial judges are often faced with a question of whether or not evidence will be prejudicial, and whether when they're weighing whether or not something can be introduced, that's the thing they have to determine, whether the probative value outweighs the possible prejudice. Another case, again, criminal law, and it was Malakow versus the New Jersey Department of Corrections. And in this case, it was an inmate, and he appealed from a determination finding him guilty of the prohibited act of failing to comply with an order to supply a urine sample within 2 hours. Plaintiff was ordered to submit the sample after corrections officers discovered a sandwich bag containing suspected tobacco in the plaintiff's locker. However, plaintiff failed to provide the urine sample within 2 hours of the request. Now, although an evaluation revealed plaintiff was suffering from a mental illness, it was still Department of Corrections concluded that it did not contribute to his behavior during the alleged interaction and infraction, that the plaintiff was competent to defend himself, and that any disciplinary sanction would not exacerbate his mental health problems. Now, on appeal, the plaintiff argued that he provided a urine sample of the required amount, that his due process rights were violated during the disciplinary hearing, and that the hearing officer ignored video evidence and that his attorney was ineffective attorney. So the court, and this is the appellate division, in fact, Judge Koblitz wrote the opinion, the court rejected plaintiff's assertion of due process violations and ineffective assistance of counsel, but reversed the imposition of sanctions and remanded for a more thorough statement of the reasons for the sanctions imposed. Specifically, the appellate division found that the Department of Corrections failed to explain why the particular sanctions were imposed as opposed to other permissible sanctions. In other words, the appellate division said, hey, if you're going to enter sanctions, you have to say why. So the court, appellate division, noted that it was unable to determine whether the hearing officer considered all of the factors set forth in the administrative code in deciding upon plaintiff's discipline. Now, this is very important because judges, and in this case, hearing officer, they need to make findings of fact and conclusions of law based on whatever the factors are. For example, in divorce cases, the judge, if there's a trial, has to make a determination whether or not alimony will be awarded if alimony is requested, and has to go down the entire list of factors that must be considered. Same thing with equitable distribution of assets. The judge has to go down and make findings of fact and conclusions of law with respect to how the assets are going to be divided. So let me play some spots from our sponsors and then get back to conclude the program.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in a critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Okay, I'm back. It's the law. A few more minutes and talk about some of the other cases and some things that have been going on. If everybody remembers the Bridgegate affair, what has happened is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit on Tuesday the majority of the Barone and Kelly convictions were upheld. What they did is the court, now this is the appellate court, the federal appellate court, they reversed the civil rights convictions for a one-time aid to Governor Chris Christie and former Port Authority official. The aide, of course, was Kelly, the official was Barone, and they were charged with orchestrating the now infamous Bridgegate scheme. However, the Third Circuit upheld convictions for wire fraud and misuse of agency property. So the Bridgegate, I think it's probably at the end, finally, after all of these years. Okay, so what else is happening? As far as cases, there was one that might be of interest. It was not approved for publication, but I think it certainly would be interest to anyone in real estate, and that is, in this case, the defendant appealed from a judgment that required him to pay the plaintiff unreturned deposit money from a failed real estate deal. The defendant was a member of the a certain group that owned property in question. In other words, he owned the property. He was part of a group that owned the property. The plaintiffs consisted of two other people, and they were operating as Coddington Communities, LLC. So in this case, the defendant drafted a real estate agreement and sent it to the plaintiffs for their review. It was apparently one of the plaintiffs sent a marked-up copy of the contract back to the defendant and expressed that he and the other owner had some questions and comments on certain provisions of the contract. So defendant revised the agreement, signed it, and sent it back. Now, the revised agreement was signed by one of the plaintiffs in January of 2016, and by the other plaintiff on February 16, so the same year. So what happened then is Coddington Communities appeared before the signature, and one of the provisions of the contract called for a 120-day due diligence period to allow the plaintiff sufficient time to conduct an environmental study on the property. Not at all unusual in commercial properties. because of the concern that there could be buried tanks, etc. So in any event, during the due diligence period, the plaintiff was entitled to terminate the contract for any reason. So it wasn't just they could terminate for if they found any environmental problems. Furthermore, the plaintiff agreed to pay a deposit upon execution of the contract. And subsequently, one of the plaintiffs informed the defendant that the results of the environmental study rendered the property undevelopable, could not be developed, and that they were terminating the deal. The defendant refused to return a portion of the deposit he used for taxes and maintenance on the property, and the plaintiff sued. So the question before the court was, when did the parties enter into a binding contract that triggered the due diligence period? The defendant argued that the period began when he circulated the draft agreement. Alternatively, the defendant argued that the contract was binding when the first plaintiff signed the contract, and that because his signature bound both of the parties. And then the plaintiffs argued that it began, the 120-day period, began with the February 16th, when the February 16th agreement was signed. So the trial judge concluded that the draft agreement, the first draft agreement, was in fact merely a bargaining. So it had nothing, you know, the first draft agreement was a bargaining position, and that it was incomplete and missing essential terms, including the signatures of the parties. And I think most people would think that, you know, if you're going back and forth with agreements, as long as somebody hasn't signed it, it's not a binding contract. In fact, in family law, this becomes a real problem when parties go to mediation and they have a mediation agreement, but nobody signs it. And, you know, thereafter, they have to, if no one has signed it, either party really can get out of the agreement because it's not considered a binding agreement unless both parties sign it. Real problem, because often what happens is, in my area of law, people will, in fact, go to mediation and think that that's the done deal, and then just sit back and not go and have an attorney draft a binding agreement and not even sign the agreement. And for some reason, many mediators really do not encourage parties to sign the agreements, because what they're doing is they're encouraging the parties to go to attorney, each of them go to their own attorney, have the attorney review the mediation agreement and explain it before they sign it. So this can be a real problem. So in this case, the trial judge was not persuaded that a contract was formed when the first plaintiff signed the deal, finding that both plaintiffs were not partners with legal authority to bind each other. So then what this means is this case could be different if, in fact, the two men were partners who had a right to bind each other. The court also found that the defendant, and by the way, the appellate court agreed with the trial judge and affirmed the decision. And the appellate court found that the defendant did not carry his burden to show that the two plaintiffs had entered into a partnership. And so that, in this case, was important because of the time that one could not, in fact, bind the other. College is always a problem and, can be a problem in divorce cases. And there was a case this week. Again, it was not binding. Excuse me, it was not published. So the case is Gillen versus Bina. Again, it was an appellate division. So these people went back to court and then went up to the appellate division. One of the things that I really don't like dealing with college cases post-judgment what parties should do, and although no court can make them do it, but they should reach an agreement as part of their overall settlement, because the last thing they want to do is spend, I would think, is spend money doing this after the fact, years later, and it can cost more to go to court than the college the tuition.
Hey, Pat.
Did you know between the two of us, we know how to screw in a light bulb?
Come on, Steve. We could do better than that. Well,
I have
at least
no idea
tell
what's
you what,
happening.
You sit there and look pretty, and I'll fix it.
Listen to you, big guy. Better yet, let's get everyone to listen to Home Sweet Home with me, Steve Bailey, Inspector with Brass Tack Home Inspections.
And I'm Pat Gregory, Handyman Extraordinaire with Taskman Home Improvements, every Friday at 11 a.m. Or you can go to our archives and get access to over 50 podcasts. We cover the basement to the attic and everything in between.
You can even call us at 908-237-0410 during our radio program about our home improvement projects. Remember, Home Sweet Home, every Friday at 11 on Hunterdon Chamber Radio.
From the basement to the attic, you're listening to Steve and Patrick. Home sweet home.
Hey folks, it's Pat saying hello to you. We're a few minutes early here, so we're just going to wait until 11 o'clock to officially start the show, but hang on tight, we'll be...
Not sure what happened there. I'm just finishing up a couple more things, and then we'll go on to the sports guys. And somehow, you know, technology is technology. Who knows what happens? In any event, I was talking about this college case, and in this case, a defendant appealed from an order granting in part his motion to compel plaintiff to contribute to the party's children's college expenses. And in this case, the parties incorporated a property settlement agreement into their judgment of divorce, under which the parties agreed to each contribute to their children's college expenses based on their respective ability to pay. And the court subsequently granted custody to the defendant and terminated his child support obligation after the children sought to live with him. The party's older son sought to attend NYU. Plaintiff disapproved of the choice because she could not afford NYU tuition and denied she had committed to pay any amount for tuition or agreed to either child attending an expensive school. After suffering a severe illness, the party's son transferred to Elon University, and thereafter defendant incurred expenses and parent loans to send the party's older son to college. The party's younger son initially attended Wake Forest University before also later transferring to Elon, with defendant incurring costs. Plaintiff again refused to contribute to future college costs, alleging she could not afford to pay or take out loans. Defendant then filed the present motion. Trial court granted the motion in part, ordering plaintiff to contribute 35% of the older son's final year of college expenses, and the trial court found that the party's unsigned consent order did not require the plaintiff to contribute to already incurred expenses, but that the property settlement agreement did require both parties to contribute. So on appeal, the court affirmed in part and reversed and remanded in part. The appellate division concurred with the trial court's conclusion that defendant agreed to absorb past college expenses and to only pursue future costs from the plaintiff. However, the court remanded to the trial court to explain its determination of a 35% share for the plaintiff and to impute income to the plaintiff. So, you know, bottom line is these folks, unless they did this themselves, probably spent more money trying to get this, you know, all of these court proceedings because this can be, you know, very expensive. We had the trial, the motion, the trial, went up to the appellate division, back to the trial court. So in any